But the essential fact is not there. The essential fact is, if we return to theoretical anti-humanism, is that Althusser repeatedly explained, that was never a mystery, that from his point of view, the kernel of the dominant ideology was not humanism alone. It was humanism plus economicism. And so I would very much agree with you that perhaps neoliberalism has this the visibility or invisibility of each side is shifting and commuting all the time. So I don't think that an Althusserian, even a traditional Althusserian, would make difficulty in admitting that the essential problem today is economicism more than humanism. But the next question would be, where is some sort of humanism more than ever insisting or hiding or latent, even in the most economicist, utilitarian discourse?
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Radical Thoughts podcast. In this episode, we discuss another text by Louis Althusser. This time, we are reading Politics and History, Montesquieu, Rousseau, and Marx. You just heard a clip of Althusser's student Etienne Balibar talking about his confrontation with humanism. But soon, you'll be hearing us discuss the nature of political theory, the value in engaging with traditional theoretical figures, and the exact nature of the Althusserian structuralist debate.
Yeah, I'm going to go with, I really like this one, but I kind of have some complaints to forward the verso about how they kind of compiled it. Doesn't really, like, I was at first kind of confused because it starts out with it has like three basic like lectures or essays, Montesquieu, Rousseau, and Marx. And the Montesquieu one is from 1959, and that's like, you know, that's pre for Marx, which is like Althusser's big, you know, contribution that he's famous for. And then the Rousseau one is from, like, I think it's from 1965 to 6. And then the final essay is, like, on Marx's relation to Hegel. It's from, like, 1968. So you, like, kind of started thinking that this is all, like, earlier Althusser texts. But then it, you know, it turns out that the rest of them aren't, and only the Montesquieu one is kind of, like, pre-for Marx. So it kind of throws you off, and it kind of like is confusing about like why they're all compiled together, because there are texts on Rousseau and Hegel and Marx by Althusser from before, like, you know, the 60s, that they could have like put together in one book. But I don't know, maybe there's a logic to it, I'm just not seeing it.
And each of the texts have markedly different purposes. Like the second text, where the Rousseau one is part, was included in, like, there is this journal in the 60s called Notebooks for Analysis, that, like, Alain Badeau was part of, and it seemed to have this more sort of structuralist approach towards Marx or theory. And then the final piece on Marx is a seminar. And so the first text is Althusser's, you know, first book. It's kind of like his it's kind of like Negri's book on Descartes. It's the first thing he put out there, but it's probably not the one he's most not the thinker who's common. No one really thinks of Althusser as someone who's famous for commenting on Montesquieu. But they remember, you know, Marx and reading Marx and reading Capital as well.
I feel like people who periodize Althusser, they usually kind of say, like, you have very early Althusser before for Marx, But this Montesquieu piece is still sort of within, it doesn't come across as like Hegelian Althusser, early Althusser, Hegelian through World War II Althusser. So it's still kind of in like the main period, like the main standard Althusserian kind of period that usually I feel like gets ended at 1968. Because the crisis of 1968 and his commitment to the PCF stance is usually seen as a kind of a period that causes a shift in his work, because so many of his students become dissatisfied with him and he starts to kind of look for new avenues of re-complicating and realigning his theory. And particularly he starts to take even more implicit but not explicit Maoist turns during that period, I think.
Kind of looks at the Cultural Revolution as like a, like an example of like a sort of a revisioning of Marxism in practice, or a kind of a rethinking of Marxism in practice itself. And, you know, basically a sort of like, you know, if Althusser is doing the philosophical version of self-critique, the Cultural Revolution is kind of like that in political practice.
Mm-hmm. So it is all kind of within at least the first stage of Althusser, even if the first one is even then a little bit early. But at the very least, it's not like one essay prior to 1968, one essay post-1968, one essay when he gets into his, I don't remember what the term is, but like, you know, like the hyper-Spinozist period, the late Mark Althusser, where it's all about, you know, like the swerving of events and things.
Yeah, the materialism of the encounters, right? And, you know, I haven't read either. This is actually the first Althusser, like early Althusser, that I've read. And I've yet to read his later, more materialism of the encounter type works. So I think that will be something I'll look at soon. But I was pretty impressed with his early work on Montesquieu, because you can see like a lot of his ideas in formation there, but not fully articulated. But you can definitely see this kind of like rejection of teleology and this kind of like look for like a kind of understanding of the totality that isn't just purely Hegelian. And he kind of sees that in Montesquieu.
Yeah. So if we start with the Montesquieu one, I feel a little bit like it's a bit difficult, because I don't think any of us are particularly experts on political theory that involves like Montesquieu as an early figure. What we were saying before we started recording, how, you know, if you're a Marxist, you probably know at least a little bit about Rousseau, because just he's a figure of the French Revolution. He's talking about community. He's talking about the people. And he's also generally seen as, both certain Marxists and critics of Marx will often uphold him as having like this kind of precursor to a theory of like primitive communism, you know, quote unquote. So you usually know something about Rousseau, but like Montesquieu, there's not a lot of stuff on the political theory of Marx in relation to Montesquieu. So I don't know a ton about him other than this book that Althusser is kind of going through on the laws. And I guess he's kind of often attributed as one of the figures of the like theorization of the division of powers.
Yeah, I think a good book to read is The New Philosophy for Communism, Rethinking Althusser by Panagiotis Soteris. I haven't read the whole thing, but I read some sections of it that were relevant to this reading. And I found it pretty interesting in kind of like tracing out, you know, what Althusser takes from Montesquieu. And I think one part, this to begin, Althusser likes about Montesquieu that he's trying to like develop a science of politics. And he's trying to do that like not from these kind of ideas of like essence and this kind of ideals of, you know, like this idea that this like society is like some expression of some like greater essence, but he's looking at the concrete societies as they actually exist, and working from there is kind of what he likes about Montesquieu. and he's trying to kind of develop, like, you know, under, like, he's trying to basically do like a kind of like a physics of politics and try to find the laws that govern politics that are expressed in the actual formal laws of like societies. And so he talks about how, you know, he also likes it about Montesquieu is that he doesn't have this idea of a social contract as the origin of society. And he kind of just assumes that society is there from the origin. There's no like pre-social, you know, state that, you know, a state of nature that then is transformed into society. Like Montesquieu kind of assumes the existence of society from the beginning. And so it kind of is an anti-teleological thing. And so, of course, Althusser being Althusser very much appreciates anything that's like anti-teleological.
Yeah, so because he says that Montesquieu like has the way that he talks about law is that priorly, you know, the idea of law is that there is an authority that hands down the law. And he says that what Montesquieu does that's so interesting is he says the law is essentially like the necessity of given relationships at any point is kind of the way I would put it. And Montesquieu goes so far as to say that even, you know, there are laws that apply to God in his relation to the world. It's at that level. Whatever the interdependence and relationships of things to one another will develop certain forces of laws that apply as those relationships are developed and constructed. And so he talks about in given political societies, the nature of it and the principle of it, and those together compose the totality. I think those are the terms he uses. The nature is basically like the actual fundamental who has power, and the principle is sort of the impetus behind it, what it aims at. So he says, like, there's the Republic, and the Republic's nature is to have the legislative assembly, and then the principle of the Republic is virtue, and then the monarch is the king and honor. So, it, like, by nature, it has, like, the king who determines things through power, and then there's honor is what its principle is based on. And then there's despotism, which has the despot, and I don't remember what the principle of despotism was off the top of my head.
Well, the principle of despotism is kind of like, it's kind of almost like a lack of a principle, and it's just pure passion, basically. Like, it's not governed by, like, laws, it's just kind of governed by arbitrary passion. But yeah, I think what Althusser is interested in here is kind of this idea that the principle and the nature are seen as kind of like a totality. And, you know, he says the principle is the concrete of the abstract, but nature is there unity, is there totality that is real. And so he's kind of doing this to argue against a formalism in Montesquieu.
I could definitely see with this the way that one of the post-Althusserian strands, the critical realism, I could definitely see how that grew out of his thought in this period. The focus on law and the search for like causality through the relationship.
Yeah, the search for like deeper, it's like a search for deeper structures of causality and mechanisms and structures and causal powers and trying to not just look at like law as like basically like registering like regularities and finding an economical way of describing them, but actually seeing law as like describing something, some deeper structure, which I think you also find in Marx as well. But yeah, it's definitely this, like you said, a kind of proto-critical realist approach, which I think might be part of why I liked it, because I like a lot of that stuff. And he also talks about, like, you know, Montesquieu, he kind of has, like, this climate determinism. And, you know, he kind of tries to balance that with his, like, idea of, like, you know, determination by, like, by the principle, I guess. Like, he kind of says Montesquieu, like, he says Montesquieu avoids danger by insisting that there is, in the last instance, a determinate form, the principle. And so he's kind of arguing that, like, he uses the term, like, you know, in the last instance, determinant. So he's actually kind of saying that, like, Montesquieu is, like, reaching towards this kind of idea of, like, the economy as determinant in the last instance. He's just not scientific enough. Like, he still has this kind of geographic determinism and whatnot. And but that's also another part that you can see as, like, a prototype of, like, four marks, of this idea of, like, overdetermination. Like, he's not quite there yet. Like, he's not, like, totally, like, arguing for overdetermination, but he is kind of using that language of, like, determination in the last instance.
I do think one of the things that's frustrating about the Montesquieu piece is precisely that Althusser is such a philosophical author that, like, one of the things that's often leveled at him is that he so theorizes Marx that you can't, it's really difficult to get to the actual, like, economic part through the way he talks about things. So I kind of felt, like, a little frustrated with, like, even if I appreciated why he was talking about this kind of totality, there's still something about this kind of discussion of, like, oh, the contradiction becomes when the nature of the state cannot produce its principle, then it, like, falls into conflict, and the nature of the masses will determine whether there is the moral impetus to return to the principle that will stabilize the state again or not. It resolves so much at the level of just kind of, like, political will.
Yeah, I think, like, you could say there's almost too much of a danger of you're trying to read too much of historical materialism into Montesquieu almost. But I think the stuff on how Montesquieu kind of represents the nobility, I thought was really interesting, because he kind of argues that, like, to the extent that, like, Montesquieu talks about liberty, he's talking about, like, the liberty of the nobility against, like, kind of impositions of the absolutist state. And he kind of argues that, there's this kind of flawed understanding of the absolutist state as, like, kind of hovering above the two classes, like the bourgeoisie and the nobility, and mediating between them. And he argues that basically, like, the bourgeoisie and nobility were kind of, like, united within this common state apparatus at this time. And it's a mistake to, like, not see it as, like, a state ruled by the nobility. It's just a state that, like, had to go against them in particular instances. I think that my kind of use of historical analysis was pretty good in there. I'm not sure, like, how, like, what the state of the historical historiographical debate is, but it did actually kind of remind me of some of the, like, political Marxist stuff that kind of argues against this idea that there's, like, a simple contradiction between the mercantile bourgeoisie and the nobility that, like, leads to the bourgeois revolutions.
I do think that part of this book is, like, part of the eclectic nature of it. It is sort of like you see the French political, like, political theoretical tradition. So I think that part of it is also, like, it feels like, oh, he's, like, scavenging into this figure and trying to draw things out. And to us, it just can appear kind of, like, out of hand, but I guess I can see why that might make more sense in the French system, where absolutism and stuff, it's like that was the experience of politics, the establishment of, like, politics.
Yeah, I mean, it's like he is, like, going through this whole French philosophical tradition and trying to orient himself into it, you know. And I think that's, I honestly like that, though. I think, you know, he's, like, I think more Marxists could use this kind of engagement with kind of, like, the classics of political theory. And he also does it with Machiavelli, not in this book, but I think, you know, like, because, you know, like, Marx is, like, you know, he's kind of establishing, like, a science of history. But there is like a, like, you know, politics does have like a kind of relative autonomy. And it's like, well, what is the like, what are the laws of politics? Like, what is the science of politics for Marxism? So I think like engaging with Machiavelli, Montesquieu, Rousseau, and, you know, people like that, I think is actually a pretty useful project for Marxism.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And it's useful to compare Althusser's analyses of the various so-called founders of political science, like Montesquieu and Machiavelli, with the later with what his vision of Marx, because it seems that Althusser discerns that these particular like theoreticians, like Montesquieu and Machiavelli, are what was on the continent of history before Marx discovered it. And so for Althusser, when Marx made that discovery of going into the continent of history and turning history into science or into an object of science, it was through engaging in a critique of those earlier figures, the figures of political science and also the figures of political economy.
Yeah, I think the kind of idea of Montesquieu is also like a kind of figure of nobility, I think, is interesting, kind of debates about like liberalism, because a lot of ideas of like liberal freedom are kind of seen. There's like historians who have argued that like liberal freedom is actually kind of like an expression of like the nobility or like the slaveholding class in the South, even for the United States, as like an expression of like their desire to not have a state like interfere with their personal like kind of rights of fiefdoms or whatever. And I think it's interesting also, like, he talks about how Montesquieu was like, he basically said that republics were impossible because the population was too big, and like a republic was like only possible in like a really small community. And so he basically argues that nobility and like monarchy is like the ideal form of state. It's just like a matter of kind of engineering the monarchy to like be rational enough to properly, you know, express the you know, the principle or whatever.
Althusser says basically that Montesquieu thinks that, you know, the principle of virtue becomes too weighty once you reach a certain kind of, you know, empirical stature and extent of your, like, needs of governance.
Well, yeah, I thought, you know, the engagement with Montesquieu from Althusser, I like it a lot, honestly, as a kind of preview of where Althusser is going. As I said before, I kind of like this project of engaging with the classic thinkers of political science from Marxist direction. So I think it's like in these figures you can also find the kind of prototype of historical materialism, like the beginnings. And I guess we can move on to talk about Rousseau. But I think it's really in Rousseau also you can see a lot of stuff that reminds me of his. Like, when I read the Discourses on the Origins of Inequality, I read that after I had read the German Ideology. And I was actually like kind of surprised at how much you could kind of see of as kind of like proto-historical materialist thought in Rousseau. Despite major differences, you know, I was kind of struck by that. And so I find these engagements of Althusser with Rousseau also to be really interesting.
And so the Rousseau piece is like this extraordinary display of like Althusserian reading, especially as he sets off in the foreword, where he's like, there are these major discrepancies or dislocations in the social contract that Rousseau tries to elude, but it's actually these problems that he doesn't quite resolve that gets deferred onto other problems that actually allow the theory of the social contract to function.
Right, and it's like his classic like symptomatic reading, like his, I guess that's kind of like his methodology, I guess, like a kind of like reading a text, not necessarily so much against the grain, as kind of like going beyond what it literally says and kind of looking at the kind of the implications that are not really stated or worked out, and then kind of like, you know, building on those. And yeah, he kind of points out these three major discrepancies in Rousseau. And which I thought was interesting, how he's basically looking at how the whole idea of the social contract, for example, he's kind of talking about how can you kind of, he says that you have like, you know, you have two recipient parties, the individual who are in like total alienation, and then the second recipient party, which is like the community. And kind of in Rousseau, there's like an exchange between these two where the individuals alienate, you know, their particular interest in the name of the community, and the community gives them like the ability to, you know, pursue their interests within the needs of the community. But he points out that like the second recipient party, the community, like doesn't exist without this alienation of the individuals that are supposedly exchanging with the community. So there's this inherent gap. And, you know, he's basically trying to like explore, you know, these kind of contradictions and discrepancies in Rousseau, and trying to kind of take them further than where they are.
And he talks about how this shift from the state of war that goes before, can be seen as prior to the social contract, is a kind of forced total alienation, and the entering into the contract is simply another a new form of alienation that works through this moment of exchange of one's own rights that then gets embodied within the community. And like you can see, you can see the link here in his reading of Rousseau with his reading of like the scientific or the later Marx, of there isn't a human subject that's prior in alienation. It is it's always alienation, I suppose. And it just seems like a anticipation of that.
Right, right. Well, it's actually not like an anticipation of it, because this is written in 65, or I think it was written in after four Marx.
Oh, indeed. No, I mean more like Althusser senses like how.
I see. Senses anticipation of it. Okay.
That's anticipated in Rousseau, but not made explicit or scientific in the way that it is that like post theses on Feuerbach. For Althusser.
Right, right. It's like Rousseau is like limited by this fact that he's like forced to kind of like see this like uncorrupted like human essence. So he has to create this like idea of the state of nature as a kind of starting point for him to like to have a concept of social humanity. He has to like create this like this theoretical construction of antisocial humanity, I guess, which would be the state of nature, which becomes a state of war. And so therefore the only way to like leave the state of war is to use a social contract. And but I think like he likes Montesquieu for like not having like this kind of pre-social origin point. But he still sees how like it's by having this like pre-social origin point, it does allow Rousseau to kind of develop a theory of historical like change, and like, you know, to see that there is like, you know, possibilities of like changing the kind of social structure itself. So there is like a progressive nature to it, even if it does like serve as this like teleological kind of you know, beginning point. But you know,
I think that Althusser also brings out where this all falls apart as a political theory after all of all the discrepancies towards a flight forward into ideology or a regression into the economy. And for Althusser, Rousseau is unable to grapple with real historical conditions and how that relates to the development of political formations. And so he has to sneak in social elements to stabilize the political system. So he either has to talk about how religious ideology can serve to produce a more harmonious state, or how certain kind of feudal economic relations can support this new state. And that's where Althusser sees Rousseau going awry and being unable to resolve the different theoretical slippages in the social contract.
Right, because he basically points out how, like, Rousseau's ideal is, like, no one is, in order to, like, have, like, a real social contract, like, you need to, like, basically, like, abolish, like, the various, like, particularities in society, according to Rousseau. But the thing is, like, it's, Rousseau can't really, like, imagine, like, because he's, like, basically living in, like, you know, a French society that's still pretty much pre-capitalist, and still a society based on social orders. And so he can only kind of, like, conceive of the leveling of social orders. Like, the solution is kind of like, well, nobody should be, like, rich enough to buy another person's labor, and no one should be so poor that they have to sell their labor to someone else. So his solution is basically, like, you know, yeoman farmers' republic, basically. Like, everyone owns their own land, or it's, like, small means of production, and engages with each other as, like, petty commodity, like, producers. And so I guess the Rousseauian solution would make me to have, like, a redistributive state where if someone gets too rich, they get, like, you know, taxed, and then it gets redistributed to people who become too poor, maybe. But and then again, he kind of admits that it's kind of, like, an impossible ideal. It's just, like, something that we should try to approximate. But it actually is very similar to what the sans-culottes in the French Revolution were fighting for, which are definitely influenced by Rousseau.
And, I mean, I find it, I mean, the final paragraph of the essay on Rousseau is fascinating because Althusser kind of argues, hey, after he couldn't sort of grapple with these theoretical issues, Rousseau fled into, like, writing fiction. So he wrote Emile and the Confessions. And after the social contract, he was no longer able to theorize. But he sort of transferred the problems from theory into literature. And it's a wild argument, but
well, it's like I said before, it's kind of like his classic, like, method of symptomatic reading. It's like, for example, when he talks about, like, Marx and Hegel, like, a lot of people can point out, like, well, yeah, but Marx still uses, like, the language of alienation and you know, humanism throughout his work, you know. But also Sarah would say, okay, but that's not the point. The point is to, like, look at, like, the kind of, to look at, like, the elements that there is a break and kind of, like, build on this, even if it's not necessarily, like, explicit. Like, it's not, like, reading a text isn't so much about, like, literally interpreting the text as it's been completely intended to be read by the author, but kind of, like, looking at the, I guess the various, symptoms or whatever of the text and kind of diagnosing them and then investigating those further. And so he would say, well, yeah, maybe Marx doesn't, like, totally, like, leave behind, like, Hegelian language or whatever until you break with Hegel, but there is, like, there is a break, and I'm identifying it and I'm diagnosing it, and I am, like, kind of building on that break and trying to fully assess the implications of it, even if Marx didn't fully understand those implications.
Yeah, no, I remember when we were doing for Marx, how he described it was there's that shift in problematics, even if like what's going on explicitly still seems Hegelian. What the sort of implicit framework behind the entirety of the work is different.
Yeah, and he's definitely doing something like that with Rousseau, which I really like. And I honestly wish more Marxists engaged with Rousseau, because I think, you know, he, in a lot of ways, like Rousseau's vision of like a social republic where, you know, kind of like creating like a political community where like freedom can be achieved in a pro-social way, where like freedom is kind of achieved through like everyone's participation in a common political community that allows, you know, through the general will, the particular can be realized. Like, I think Rousseau is hinting at communism here, or he's hinting at least at like the dictatorship of the proletariat. He's just doing so in like a society where there isn't a large proletariat. And so he's able to like make a move forward in ideology, but backwards in economy, I think is kind of how Althusser phrases it. Like he sees like the issue of, he's able to move forward like towards like a new kind of sense of politics and freedom. But the only way he can see it being achieved is by regressing economically. And so it's another kind of discrepancy in Rousseau that Althusser is mentioning. I think, you know, it's kind of just like he's a product of his time. You know, it's the rise of the modern proletariat is like what allows like kind of scientific socialism to be developed. And so, you know, Rousseau is only able to kind of grasp at these problems in a limited way, but he is very like ahead of his time in grasping at these problems. I think there is a lot that Marxists could learn from careful reading of Rousseau. Now, Althusser wrote on Rousseau a few times. He has, he wrote on him in 1955 to 56, 1958 to 59, 1965 to 66, and in 1972. And this is a 65 to 66 one. But honestly, I would like to have read like his earlier stuff on Rousseau that's more like from the same time period as the Montesquieu one, because it'd be interesting to see like how much his writings on Rousseau are kind of like, you know, prequels to the stuff in For Marx, and how much his reading of Rousseau kind of develops the kind of theoretical anti-humanism and structuralism and anti-teleology and all the stuff from Althusser.
I think there is a collection of his early writings, but it might only be his Hegel stuff.
Yeah, there's the Hegel stuff that Verso.
Oh, there is a book, Lessons on Rousseau, but that's not in the series.
Yeah, that's the 1972 one. Okay. There is the Lessons on Rousseau, which I still have yet to read, but yeah, it'll be interesting to read that and see where he goes with that. Then after the Rousseau one, he has just like a short little thing on Marx's relation to Hegel. I'm not sure what the story behind this one is. It just feels like they kind of just like threw, it's like a random essay he wrote, and they decided to just like throw it back there for the sake of like making it like a fuller collection. Like, it's not a bad essay or anything. It's just like, I don't really see how it relates to the other two. The other two, it's like, here we have like examples of Althusser like dealing with like, you know, classic thinkers of the French political sciences, you know, Rousseau, Montesquieu, you know, classic kind of Enlightenment like thinkers. And then it's kind of just like a like an appendix. So it's just like a random essay about the break of Marx and Hegel. So yeah, I was kind of confused why they chose this one. Maybe there is a logic, I'm just not seeing it, but
yeah, no, I encountered one book review of this text from the 70s, and it seems that the reviewer suggests that this seminar text was included in this collection because it contains like very sort of brief modifications or corrections to Althusser's readings of Marx in For Marx and Reading Capital. And this reviewer suggests that What's most significant about this seminar is the inclusion of that idea of the process without a subject. So there's where Althusser's like big argument in Four Marks, putting it like very crudely, is there's a big epistemological rupture in Marx's work from a humanist Marx to a scientific Marx, and it all has to do with the idea of like a humanist subject and alienation. He switches from viewing capitalism as something that alienates a sort of a human essence to shifting towards more of a, like an impersonal system. And I believe some people were critical of Althusser because they felt that his vision of capitalism like excluded class struggle, and so process without a subject became like Althusser's way of talking about class struggle without like the without the revolutionary subject, without the subject. And in his later work, when it gets to philosophy of an encounter, he will develop that a lot more. But this seems like this seminar text seems just like a hint of where Althusser's work will be going later, but it is just very, it is very fragmentary. And if it's placed outside of the context of like his other work on Marx, then it does seem a little superfluous.
Yeah, like it feels like it would fit better as like an appendix in his like essays and self-criticism, maybe. Or one of those books. But yeah, I think I did like it, though, because he does talk about like what he takes from Hegel, which is kind of this idea of like process. Like he says, you know, with dialectics, it's, you know, what we take from it is, you know, a transfiguration of the existing state of things, the fait accompli, the existing order. The dialectic is the benediction of the existing order. Or critical and revolutionary. It implies a relativity of every established order, social and theoretical, of societies and of systems of institutions and concepts. A dialectic is a critique of the absolute by historical relativism. Seeing very clear angles, the dialectic sets concepts in motion, a direct adoption of the Hegelian theme, reason as critique of the intellect. Reason sets the concepts of the intellect in motion. If any kind of argues that, you know, you know, this whole idea of a dialectic is like kind of, there's, you know, a rational kernel, the Hegel, and he basically argues that it's like, you know, this whole idea of the process. And so he kind of takes from that, like, from Hegel, the idea of history as a process without a subject. So I think it's like, you know, he does, like, I think it's kind of, this essay was interesting to me because he does make it clear, but he doesn't, like, completely disregard Hegel as important. Like, he does think that we do have to, like, take things from Hegel. He's just not, like, he just doesn't think that, like, Hegelianism is, like, you know, the answer to, like, the problems and the gaps in Marx's philosophy. But yeah, he talks about Fehrbach and how he kind of tries to, like, make this impossible unity of man and nature as, like, a solution to all the problems of Kant and Hegel's philosophy and how it's just not tenable. And, you know, Marx is, you know, taking up this theoretical humanism of Fehrbach, and but then he breaks with it to, you know, create, you know, the science of historical materialism. I don't know. So it's nothing groundbreaking for Althusser, but it's a decent little essay. I feel like I've become more open to the theoretical anti-humanism over the years. Because at first, like, I think a problem with it is, like, the term, like, you know, you hear anti-humanism, and you're like, well, like, you know, why would we be against humanism? Like, you know, I think, you know, like obviously like there are certain like things like, you know, we believe in like human freedom and fighting for that and et cetera, like, you know, I think like in like the first time I was the first time I heard the word humanism, I think was the term secular humanism was kind of like a fancier term for atheism. But and so humanism is kind of like, you know, just like anything that says that, like, you know, human beings matter and that like human freedom matters or whatever is kind of labeled as humanism. But I think like theoretical anti-humanism for Althusser is like a more specific type of argument about this idea that like if you're trying to like have like a scientific analysis of like a society or history, like you can't really treat like human agency as such as like a casual factor. Like we can't just say that like, well, like you know, this agent, like human, like this human drive for agency and self-control is like what explains like this. Like we have to look at the actual social relations that humans are embedded in first. And I think, you know, I think a lot of Althusserians go too far with it. I think that it is possible to kind of like take the anti-humanism too far and like in a dogmatic way. But I do think there is like a value to it. And like I get this when I read stuff like Dunayevskaya and like some of the more Hegelian Marxists. You know, they'll just kind of have these like poetic odes to like human freedom and agency. And it just seems to be kind of like hand wavy in a way, like just not really explaining anything.
I don't know if it really changed my opinion a whole lot. I'm not someone who's read a ton of Althusser because I basically read 4 Marx and then some individual essays, and I haven't really gone outside this period of him. I think there is a complication about like what is meant, yeah, like with anti-humanism and stuff is more about the conception of how do you deal with the basic fact that human action is usually influenced by forces that you can't consciously be thinking about when you act. And so you can't take like just some sort of like principle of free human behavior as like the driving force. Though I think at the same time, I do think there are people that tend to take it too far. And ironically, for all the stuff against teleology, I think there are people who take it too far and just read into like a different sort of like mechanistic last instance determination of human behavior. It's one of the reasons that I've come to really like Bourdieu, as I think he talks about like he doesn't trust talk of subjectivity as this like final determining instance of everything where people are just subjects who like define themselves, but he says that like there's a more complicated sense of agency where like the agent is someone who is interested in their own action, but they don't necessarily know, you don't have to have full comprehension of your own actions to take action and to have decision making an action. And that's what like defines the difference between a subject and an agent in a way, which I've always thought was like a useful kind of distinction.
Right. Yeah, I think the way that critical realists talk about it, I think is pretty useful. Like it does, like they do say that, for example, like a human intention can be a casual factor, right? Like someone having a certain idea in their head and intending to do something, like that is like a kind of casual factor within the total like system of different casual factors and mechanisms. But it's just like, It's not because of this kind of, you know, human essence of subjectivity where everything is like determined by human subjects. It's just like there are like, you know, like, yeah, there are like psychoanalytic, for example, like causal factors that exist at the level of the individual. But it's also like when we're talking about history, we're not going to start at the level of the individual, we're going to start at the level of social relations and work our way down to the individual. And I think Like, one thing that got me, like, more, like, sympathetic to the theoretical anti-humanism in Althusser was reading his essays in self-criticism. Have you guys read that?
No, I haven't gotten to those.
I actually recommend it quite a bit, because he actually does, like, self-critique a lot of his formulations and four marks. Like, he basically admits to kind of, like, being a rationalist too much. And kind of, in the name of, like, fighting, like, empiricist philosophy, he kind of bends the stick too far in the direction of rationalism. But he also, like, clarifies, like, what theoretical anti-humanism actually means. And it's interesting because he basically argues that, like, humanist ideology serves a role in communist practice in the sense that, like, you know, there is an ideology of human freedom that we're fighting for. And, you know, we work in this kind of ideological environment where we, you know, have these ideals and these ethics of, like, human freedom. But we also have to demarcate that from science, per se. And, like, when we're doing, like, a science of society and a historical materialist analysis, like, we can't, like, you know, mistake this kind of ideology of humanism as some kind of, like, explanatory, like, tool that gives us a scientific, like, understanding of what's going on in a social formation. I think that is kind of reasonable, but then again, like, it does kind of, like, create this, like, divide between the sciences and the humanities that's always kind of haunted, you know, theory, I guess.
I do think it is difficult to deal with sometimes how, I mean, it's less obvious in this period of Althusser, but as he goes on and becomes a little bit more, like, structural functionalist, that the kind of sociological analysis always sort of defaults to just a sense of, like, X thing exists because it's useful for Y broad social institution, which it's like, if you're someone who's taking a critique of society, like, yes, you're probably going to have some sense that there is a kind of, like, domination of these capitalist institutions, like, ideologically, but, like, that they favor certain, like, out stances and positions and needs. But at the same time, I do think it's like, I think that there is sometimes an undervalued degree to which people examine that, like, structuralism and functionalism were actually both, like, opposed theories at a certain point. And a lot of people who deal with Althusser just, like, don't examine that those weren't assumed to be the same for a long time. And kind of when he gets into that sort of level of analysis, I think that's when it gets somewhat most problematic, is that it just kind of assumes that if you see something, it's kind of there because of the apparatus or whatever that just, like, ensures that it's there. And if the apparatus didn't want it there, it wouldn't be there, kind of thing. Like, it becomes difficult to deal with the level of analyzing how any institution under capitalism can actually be quite incompetent at its own needs and demands in a certain way.
Right, right. I think, like, it's like the whole, it's, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's kind of like class reductionism. Like, kind of like, for example, like, if you're understanding, like, you know, like, understanding COVID lockdowns in terms of, like, the capitalist class's need to, like, solely in terms of the capitalist class's need to, like, you know, maintain profit, I mean, that kind of falls apart because, you know, the capitalist class needs, like, you know, it needs the circulation of commodities, and that goes against it. And so you understand, like, these institutions also have, like, their own, like, their public health has, like, an institutional purpose that can't just be, like, reduced to its, like, uses for the capitalist class, right? And obviously, like, its institutions are, they're not autonomous from the capitalist class, and they're, function becomes like influenced and even dominated by the needs of the capitalist class, but there's still more to it than just that, you know?
Yeah. Or like on the other hand, it's like, you know, is the drive for vaccines in part because they want to ensure that lockdown isn't too costly and they want people to be working? Sure, like on some level that's going on, but does that mean that the like institutional production and research for like these things is just a manufactured, you know, aspect of capital to control like human labor or something? There's a lot more contradictions for that, and like there's a lot of weird things about like how they actually stifle a great deal of like production for vaccines and things because it's actually quite difficult to profitably produce that kind of thing for public well-being.
Yeah, I think like one thing I do find interesting in Althusser is kind of his idea that like ideology, politics, and, you know, the economic is like determined in the last instance, but these other like fields, I guess, to use the kind of Bourdieuian term or whatever, that they have their own relative autonomy and like their own contradictions and their own kind of laws of motion. And so it allows you to kind of say that, like, you know, politics, you know, it does have like a relative autonomy. It's not just completely like a, you know, an expression of economics in this, like, you know, completely in this like vulgar sense. Like, there are, like, you know, laws of politics that do exist with some kind of, that aren't reducible to the laws of the economy. And so, you know, when we're doing, like, a political analysis, we kind of have to understand, like, what, you know, these political tendencies and laws are. Which I guess could be, like, a, you know, I think that's... And one thing, I feel like one thing we kind of need is like a more Marxist political science, almost. Like, a political science has a field that's like such a bad rep, but, you know, maybe the, you know, there is a kind of project in Althusser's look at Montesquieu and Rousseau and Machiavelli, a kind of like preview of like what a communist political science would look like.
Yeah, because I think it's difficult to think about what politics would mean in hypothetically a society that is driven by a sense of like self-management, where
right
you're
like a classless
a classless politics, which would theoretically become some sort of almost stateless politics, though not necessarily one without decision making and negotiation on behalf of interested parties.
No, right. I think that's kind of like something I've struggled with in Marxism, is whether or not politics is like whether we can say that politics can exist in a classless society, because the idea is like classless society, the state no longer exists because there's no need for like repressive institutions to kind of like meld classes together and to ensure the reproduction of society against class conflict. But at the same time, like, you know, there still is like a need to create a social surplus and for humans to, you know, to make decisions on how this surplus is distributed, right? So, you know, the question is, like, you know, would that kind of negotiation between different interest groups and different, you know, particular, like, you know, locations in a division of labor and different, because, you know, communism is not going to be able to completely, like, you know, dissolve all human differentiation that makes any kind of conflict over how to distribute a resource go away. Like, maybe some, like, super, like, you know, crank people do believe that. But the reality of the situation is, like, I don't think that's possible. I don't think it's... We can get rid of the class contradictions that make it impossible to have, like, a peaceful, you know, reconciliation amongst people over how to, negotiate distribution of resources, but I don't think that we can get rid of that reality of needing to make collective decisions over how, you know, society is going to run in that basic sense. And so, like, you know, I've kind of argued that, and, like, you know, because, like, both Engels and Lenin say that, like, under communism, like, democracy withers away because democracy is a form of the state, and the state withers away. But I don't really know if I agree with that, because I think, like, there still is, like, a need for, like, democratically, you know, made decisions to, you know, to do, like, what would be called politics.
Yeah.
Post, you know, capitalism.
I mean, it's one of those things where it's, like, ironically, you almost end up with a kind of, you almost end up reverting to, like, the need for that kind of humanistic impulse of, like, you need the capacity of individuals to need to state their interests and to have their activity as part of a, like, process where they recognize, like, how what they're doing is involved with something. And, like, if you think about, like, the activity of any individual workplace or city, like, you need that need, like, you need to have that kind of, like, recognition of them saying, like, well, like, we need to petition on behalf of what our interests are, but hopefully to negotiate what our own sites of production can contribute to solve, like, these broader problems, rather than hoping that there's just some automatic mechanism per se that's going to, yeah, like, determine what happens.
Well, it's like, you know, I think one of the problems with, like, humanist Marxism is, like, you get this in, like, I think even, like, Bordiga and Kamat, I think, have this tendency of, like, basically imagining that there's, like, this organic community that is basically without divisions, and the rise of class society was, like, the breakup of the organic community so that it no longer is able to, you know, organically, you know, meet its needs. And communism is, like, a return to the organic community, but with modern forces of production, basically. And so there's, like a kind of a loss of all the divisions that make something like democracy and political antagonism at all, like, a thing. But I think it's a dangerous line of thought, in my opinion, because if you come to this idea that, like, you know, we're trying to completely abolish, you know, political antagonism, and that all political antagonism is, like, a relic of class society, you know, like, it can kind of lead, you know, to a kind of a clamping down of political antagonism to kind of hide it and prevent it from being expressed, and it will just come back in, like, a nastier form, which is kind of, like, you know, I think of, like, the USSR, for example, like, you know, the kind of the way that under Stalinism, like, because, like, political antagonisms amongst the Bolsheviks couldn't be, like, openly expressed and democratically decided, they had to be repressed, and that meant that the only way to, like, create a uniformity was through the purge, basically. Yeah.
I mean, I think something of the difference is that some, like, Bordiga and Kamat are explicitly anti-democratic, and that because they think that the organic unity fundamentally eliminates the need for a separate sphere of decision making, which democratic input would be like given to. And to some degree, I can understand, like, I can understand the critique of saying, like, ideally, in a communist society, what you want is you want to have such a level of social accountancy that the capacity of persons to act and to take action on their own requires no separation of their interests to a separate sphere, so that they can just choose to make their own, like, they can just be pursuing interests in a way that is, like, socially embedded. But I think that, like, on the other hand, you have kind of the more the Hegelian Marxism, that's a humanist Marxism, that's a little bit more kind of like, I mean, the iconic examples, which Bordiga actually didn't like, even though they're strangely associated now, is kind of like the council communists, or like socialism or barbarism, or or like C.L.R. James, or these kind of like semi-councilist groups that were explicitly about like the capacity of democracy to be about the ability of human agents to involve their activity in the broader group industrial like development. Yeah, I think in some sense democratic politics will have to exist. I think it's a matter of integrating what we would call now like democratic politics, not into a separate sphere, but of integrating that decision making more and more into daily life without the nightmare of like Paracon. Every single thing that happens has to be a meeting.
Right, yeah. There's like certain decision-making that we can just kind of automate, you know? Like, we don't have to have it so that, like, you know, how many screws that, you know, are produced for the daily, like, at the daily factories voted on or whatever, like...
No, no. Andrew, do you have any big thoughts? I feel like we've dominated this discussion for a bunch of it.
I have some little thoughts. it does feel like that's where Althusser's work does go in the future. I mean, I always find it difficult where to start discussing Althusser because there are so many different periods of his work, and it was also now wrapped up in his reception in like the Anglosphere world and this proliferation of Althusserians. So I don't know. Yeah, as I said, little thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would recommend this book. I have some complaints about what was chosen for the compilation, but you know, I wouldn't call myself an Althusserian, but I think I'm probably the most sympathetic to Althusser here. So I mean, and you know, I find his very thought provoking. So I found this to be a collection worth reading. So honestly, I think like almost any Althusser collection I would probably find worth reading, so I'm biased on that one.
A super big Althusser expert. Most of the approaches to Althusser that I've enjoyed have been ones that highlight the good points he's made while showing how his embeddedness in a certain interpretation of structuralism and French communism are not always like well understood.
Yeah, yeah.
In English readers, this is something that was like brought up, I think, when we did Four Marks and when I interviewed Hurley for our podcast, because I like the Gregory Elliott biography of Althusser, some of the stuff by Perry Anderson where he tries to kind of merge Thompson's critique of Althusser with the insights of what Althusser is doing at a structural level.
Yeah.
And I think he's just someone that's difficult to read because he has different periods and self-critiques and, you know, kind of breaks in his own thinking, which are not always like evident when you're like reading people that use like a quote unquote Althusserian framework. Like they'll say like, oh, I'm Althusserian, but you don't actually know, you know, what they mean, because someone who's an Althusserian could be someone who's using Four Marks and reading Capital, or they could be someone who's using this hyper speculative Spinozist like framework, and it's kind of like they're not entirely that similar. So I mean, I think it's interesting. Like, I think it's somewhat interesting to just have it be almost as eclectic as this collection is. It is kind of easier to read him when he's sort of just being like reviewing the political thought of a couple of figures and reading it in his style, rather than maybe something like reading Capital or something where he's trying to apply this like huge philosophical framework.
Yeah.
And reinterpretation of something. So I could definitely appreciate that.
That's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us on this second Althusser text. Next up, we'll be reading one of Althusser's students, Jacques Rancière. I have no idea how to pronounce that, but we'll be reading his book, On the Shores of Politics. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time.
Humanism. The moral aspect of the question of humanism, which you can associate with human rights, solidarity, compassion, etc. There are nuances which are not unimportant. So Althusser found himself trapped, in a sense, in this dispute because he was hit in the back by the accusation. We know only too well why you are against humanism. That's because you defend brutal policies, dictatorial regimes. Inhuman concepts of politics, whereas the question which is on the order of the day are the human rights. So he struggled to explain that the theoretical anti-humanism he had been talking about was not, of course, a practical anti-humanism.